It's Jobs Day Friday, you guys. Three guesses where we're going to start. You know the rules. The first two don't count. From American Public Media, yes, I am 7 years old. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 4th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are, as of today, and according to the United States Department of Labor, 157,301,000 people in the American labor force. We learned this morning that 5% of that total, same as last month, are unemployed. 211,000 people got new jobs in this economy last month. In what I'm guessing the next two voices you are going to hear will say was a pretty good, if not great, November jobs report. Those voices belong to Lynette Lopez. She's at Business Insider. Sadiq Reddy is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Lynette, gut check here. Pretty good, right? But not necessarily great?
I mean, not necessarily great. We're still, you know what I'm going to say, we're still seeing...
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, wages.
Wage growth.
Yeah.
Just up 0.2%. 0.2%. We want to see better wage growth, but this is enough for Janet. She will raise rates. It will be exciting. The first time we've had a raise hike since 2006.
I mean,
so many people in the world have never lived through a rate hike.
I know.
They're going to have their minds.
I know. I know. Now batting, number 42. Anyway, whole different thing. Sadiq Reddy, what do you think? Good jobs report?
It is a good jobs report. It is. We've been waiting for so long to see wage growth. We are starting to see wage growth. Maybe we're going to see a little bit more of it around the corner. But, I mean, it's been 6.5 years since the recession ended, 7 years since the Fed pushed interest rates down to zero. This is not the kind of recovery we ever expected along the way. We thought it would happen so much sooner. So at least it's happening now, but it's not amazing. It's better than a lot of the world, though.
Do you suppose, Lynette, that the Fed has just shrugged and said, you know what, we got to raise. We just got it because everybody's ready for it. And come on, it's not getting any better. This is the new normal deal. And here comes the rate rise.
I think that the Fed has always said that once the economy gets going, we're going to raise rates so that we don't punish savers. So that, you know, I mean, this, as far as we know, in the world of economics, this is the normal way an economy works, right?
as far as we know.
We're just going to go with it. We made up economics in the first place, so we're going to go with it.
Wait, I thought it was Adam Smith and the English, but that's a whole different deal.
It's a collective we.
There you go. Sadiq, last thing on rates, and then I want to move on. Forget the December meeting in like 10 days, 2 weeks. Talk to me about the meeting after that, the second rise, because what's that going to do?
It's the second and the third and the fourth that markets are really trying to figure out. And the first rate increase, it's a done deal. Everyone's expecting it now. It's what the path looks like after that. We know from Janet Yellen, her message this week is that interest rates will be incredibly low for years and years. And this is going to be a test of how low they're going to be. Interest rates are not going to get back to pre-recession levels before our next recession comes. So everyone can calm down about that. But the message from the Fed is going to be, everyone, cool it. We're going to still have low rates for years and years to come. And if markets believe it, then we should be in pretty decent shape.
All right. So let's move on from all that stuff. Lynette, I will give you the choice of which question you want to answer. Do you want to talk about Mark Zuckerberg and his philanthropic thing this week? Or do you want to talk about Marissa Mayer, the CEO of Yahoo, and all the hullabaloo about them maybe selling their core business? This is one of the original.
I want to talk about Marissa Mayer.
Ready, go.
It takes me no time to talk about.
Get you all spooled up,
Marissa Mayer. I think the most interesting thing that we've seen is that for years and years, investors on her board have been waiting for her to make a move that makes the company grow again, that helps Yahoo understand its identity. Is it a search site? Is it a media site?
Right.
What is it? Nobody seems to understand it. And now what their plan was they were going to spin off Alibaba, have all this cash, and make some moves to really clarify what Yahoo is. But it turns out that Yahoo spinoff might be more expensive than they thought. So this guy, Jeff Smith, who is a hedge fund manager, Starboard Capital, he's the guy who lowered the number of breadsticks on your table at Olive Garden, America. Anyway, he sits on the board of Yahoo, and he wrote a scathing letter saying that if you can't spin off Alibaba, you've got to sell the core business. You've got to sell the search. You've got to sell the email. Because you need to raise cash and you need to figure out who you are. And
so give me your opinion here. What do you think? Bad idea? Good idea? Gonna happen? Not happen?
I think Jeff Jeff Smith is right. Yahoo is lost. I mean, the stock has declined a significant amount. Marissa seems to not have the vision to be able to lead the company into a new era. Smith has been very, very excellent on making value judgments on a lot of his investments, including Olive Garden. And he's stuck with the company for years and years waiting for some kind of change, and he's getting impatient, and so are the rest of the investors in the company, right, quite frankly.
We will see what happens with that. Sudeep, I want to talk quickly about Zuckerberg. Here he is giving away 99% of his shares, but he's doing it in a way that's making people say, oh, now, wait a minute, man, come on, you're not really giving them away. Is he getting a hard time for some serious philanthropy here?
He is getting a hard time, but it's not quite philanthropy yet. What he's probably planning to do is bigger than what you would think of as philanthropy, which is why there's so much confusion around it. He wants to do something that is over in the long run going to mean more than even Facebook means. And so he's got a huge pile of money now. He can work on that and he can think about it. But we tend to think small about what can be done when it comes to philanthropy, when it comes to using $45 billion in the world. And he wants to think big, and that should be applauded. He wants to bring that mindset from Silicon Valley, from the tech industry, to come up with transformational breakthroughs. So we don't know what that is. He doesn't know what that is. But that's actually what's pretty exciting about it, is that he has committed his huge boatload of money to this project, to this idea of making something bigger in the world.
Sudeep Reddy at The Wall Street Journal, Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good one, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. You too. Traders love them. Some of that jobs report action today. Guess they have made peace with the looming rate hike. I'd say that. Yeah, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a story out of Vienna that's worth a moment here. OPEC, more properly the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, met there today to ponder the low price of crude and, more to the point, to ponder whether members ought to cut production to get prices off the $40 or so a barrel that crude is sitting at right now. They decided members ought not cut production. In fact, technically, they are increasing the amount they pump by 1.5 million barrels a day. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what's going on here.
With a global oil glut and prices constantly slipping, oil producers are in trouble. So today's meeting was tense. Indonesia, which rejoined OPEC today, must wonder what it's getting into. Worse still, its presence adds about another 1 million barrels of OPEC oil a day to the market. And once Iran starts pumping out the black stuff again, well, let's not even go there. The key question, who's going to take the lead to cut production? Well, you jump first. Dominic Haywood, an oil analyst at Energy Aspects, says at the meeting all eyes were on Saudi Arabia.
But they've made it very clear that they don't think it's up to them, and also they don't necessarily think it's up to OPEC to cut production.
The Saudis' plan is to maximize market share and to drive high-cost producers like the ones in North Dakota and Texas out of business. Guy Caruso is an energy advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It's working, but much slower than I think anybody, including the Saudis, thought.
With $700 billion in cash reserves, Saudi Arabia can afford to wait. Jason Bordoff of Columbia University is a former energy advisor to President Obama. He says some OPEC members, like Venezuela and Ecuador, can't.
When countries who are dependent on petroleum revenues see a sharp decline in the global price, they have as much pressure as possible to boost output in any way they can because they need the money.
Meanwhile, oil inventory keeps rising. Bordoff says concerns about the oil glut make sense, but production is only part of the equation.
The big question is how quickly demand keeps growing. We saw very strong demand growth this year in response to the low price, almost 2 million barrels a day of growth. That's going to have a big impact on how quickly we start to push the price back up.
A lot depends on China, the world's oil-guzzling second biggest economy. If growth there continues to stall, demand might do the same. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Crude in New York today, by the by, down under $40 a barrel at the close. $39.97 was the price. Over in Paris, the UN's big climate change conference wrapped up its first week today. And now that all the politicians are gone, actual negotiations starting to happen, focused on the real-life ramifications of a warming planet. Among those are rising sea levels. In places like the Mekong River Delta in southern Vietnam, life revolves around water. People spend a whole lot of their time in boats, even grocery shops and gas stations are on the water. But now the floodplains that have helped that region become the rice bowl of Vietnam are facing rising seas. The BBC's Fergus Nichol reports.
Daddy, It's a little after 6 in the morning, and this floating market has been going strong since around 3. Instead of supermarket aisles, our little boat is running slowly between the long, lean wooden hulls of market sampans, and some of them are lying low in the water with the weight of their cargo. There are 2 side by side over there, simply groaning with mounds of slim green pineapples. A lot of the small boats are steered along by women in the typical conical straw hats. That boat over there has what looks like sweet potatoes or cassava in transparent plastic sacks piled on the deck. Carrots, there are onions over there, and it all looks together like an incredibly bountiful place, but the pressures on the farmers here in the Delta have been growing steadily every year.
In previous years, when the weather was good, we could farm rice as well as seafood. Our livelihoods were secure. But over the last year, the weather has changed and the water level has dropped significantly, so we can't farm fish or shrimp.
Those upstream dams in Laos and Cambodia are worrying the WWF, a charity devoted to protecting the wildlife and the environment. Mark Guasho is from the WWF's Greater Mekong Project. He says the level of development in the region is having an alarming impact on the ecosystem.
Things have changed drastically over the past 20 years, meaning entire villages are falling at sea.
Out on the water now, on the river delta of 9 Dragons, and moving along one of those 9 main branches of the Mekong, you get a real sense not just of the scale of this enormous biosystem, but also of its proximity to the sea, because the entire population of the Mekong Delta lives less than 3 meters above sea level. So rising ocean levels, coupled with coastal erosion that's already eating into hundreds of meters of shoreline, are very real problems. But they're far from the only problems here. Temperatures are rising, measured and proven. Rainfall is falling, also measured and proven. And now add in the creeping salination of the rice-growing croplands by encroaching seawater, and you have a collision of potentially devastating elements.
The BBC's Fergus Nicol for us in the Mekong Delta in southern Vietnam. All right, now this one from the Marketplace desk of Just Because They Can, I guess. If you want to go car shopping in Nashville, Tennessee, there's something new there that you can try, the latest and greatest in auto buying technology. All right, not really, but car sales is a cutthroat business, as Blake Farmer explains from WPLN in Nashville, so a company's got to do what a company's got to do.
Like any vending machine, this one takes coins, but they're just for show. Drop the oversized token in the slot, and the gears start turning.
That is the sound on the inside of a car vending machine. What is happening?
So it just went and put a car up, and now it's going to go grab another one and bring it down for us.
Ernie Garcia is the CEO of Carvana. It's a Phoenix-based startup that began selling used cars online 3 years ago. It built a more modest one-story vending machine in Atlanta, but this glass tower filled with 20 cars is the first of many planned for cities across the country, Garcia says. I ask, is this just a gimmick?
You called it a gimmick, which is basically a stab in the heart, so I'm going to give me a second to recover from that.
I'll let him make his case. First, he says the word of mouth reduces the need for traditional advertising, which is a huge cost for most car dealers.
So if we can build an experience that's really interesting, that customers talk about and are excited about, that actually saves us money, which we can then pass on to them again.
People are definitely talking. Anya Clay works next door at an import auto maintenance shop. Customers have been asking what's going on for months.
Oh yeah, what is Carvana? Yeah, for the most part, what is that? And then we just reply, it's a car vending machine. I mean, elevator on cars in a tower, it's very unique. It's very eye-catching.
Even more flashy now that it's done, with the glowing neon lights and a giant sign that reads, yes, this is a car vending machine. No, you cannot shake it for a free one. So this thing is getting attention, including from reporters like me, for instance.
Second reason Garcia says this makes sense, it may save Carvana money on shipping, which is the make-or-break element of running an online dealership.
How do you manage that cost at the end of the day?
Ben Freeland should know. He had a website called Auto to Auto that sold used cars online and transported them around the country. The company went out of business during the recession, in part because of a hiccup in its delivery model.
So if you're delivering, you know, to someone's physical door, you know, there's complexities with urban markets and different, just a lot of different things that you've got to deal with as you go across the country.
Home delivery costs Carvana about $200 per vehicle. The company's still offering that service free of charge, but Garcia, the CEO, is hoping some buyers will be willing to drive to this central location instead. They still purchase the car online, but before they arrive for the pickup, it's loaded into the vending machine to create some drama around the transaction.
When a customer comes here, they save us money by not making us go drive to them. And then we're able to kind of take that savings and invest it in an experience that we think is really fun for them.
Garcia won't say how much this German-engineered car vending machine cost him to design and build, only that it was less than the typical startup investment for a car lot. And he assures me that there's a repairman on standby so he never has to put up that dreaded out-of-order sign on this vending machine. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's not going to affect us when that plant is shut down. Just everybody we love around here is going to go, and that's sad.
The long, slow decline of a company town. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. On a Friday, the Dow Industrial is up 369 points, 2.1%, closed at 17,847. The NASDAQ increased 104 points, 2%, finished at 5142. The S&P 500 advanced 42 points, also 2%, to end at 2,091. The logic, I think, goes like this. Good jobs report meaning the economy is strong. Fed's going to raise. That means the economy is strong, so we're all making money. I don't know. For the week, the Dow rose 0.3%. Ditto for the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 added 0.1% today. Quick look at energy after that OPEC meeting we told you about. Royal Dutch Shell slipped 2%. ExxonMobil grew about 0.5% or so. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.27%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In southern Ohio, in the Appalachian foothills, there's a tiny town called Piketon. It's a company town, but in kind of an unconventional way. The company was a Cold War-era uranium enrichment plant that back in the day was a giant project of the federal government. The feds stopped enriching uranium there about 15 years ago, but still almost 2,000 people go to work there every day just cleaning the place up. And as Lewis Wallace from WYSO reports, some of those cleanup jobs could now be on the line.
My Pike County history experts are sitting side by side on their living room couch holding hands.
I'm Norman Anderson.
And I'm his lovely wife, Betty Jo. And I've lived here as long as he has.
Norm and Betty Jo have been here since the mid-50s, when Norm started working at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant. He's 82 and retired, but he was a popular guy at work.
I was called Hardhead because I had my way of doing things.
Actually,
I wanted to get something done.
Hardhead started here while the federal government was building the plant, and for decades he worked in one of three buildings where uranium was enriched using a lot of heat and pressure.
It's hard to tell people of the magnitude of that those buildings.
When they were built, they were some of the biggest buildings in the world, up in the hills above Piketon, 33 acres on one floor.
And those were all concrete floors. And you imagine pouring 33 acres of concrete.
So in the 50s, this was a boom town. There were 27,000 people on site to build the plant. Housing went up in rows almost overnight. And the plant still employed thousands of people through the 1990s. First, the enriched uranium was used for bombs, then submarines and power plants. Now things are different.
We're disassembling it, literally piece by piece right now.
This is Jeff Wagner, the PR guy for Fluor, the contractor that's running the Portsmouth cleanup. We're outside the web of chain link and razor wire that encloses the plant. In the oldest building inside, there's a Star Trek-type control room. Old-school analog gauges cover every wall. I couldn't record in there, but I met three guys whose job is to sit there in shifts, 24/7, monitoring for leaks in the old industrial equipment. In the newest building, that equipment is being cleaned and removed, wrapped in thick plastic for shipment. Where?
It goes to a DOE certified disposal site in Nevada.
The Department of Energy oversees the whole thing. On top of the contaminated machinery, the agency is dealing with chemical spills, the kind that were sort of routine back in the 50s and 60s, but now known to be toxic. The whole cleanup is expected to take at least until 2042, Wagner says. And there's the B word.
The timeline is really predicated on the budget.
The budget. That's what Fluor and Ohio senators have been jostling with the feds about. The budget for this project has fluctuated. This summer, hundreds of workers at the plant got layoff warnings and offers of buyouts. That's because the budget for fiscal year 2016 might go down about $50 million from 2015. Betty Jo and Norm Hardhead Anderson say Piketon's already struggling.
I mean, this area just doesn't have anything. You know, we don't have industry anymore like we used to. We used to have steel mills. We used to have shoe factories.
Here's the conundrum. If the cleanup slows down because of layoffs, that means a longer time living in the shadow of the Cold War. But when the cleanup finishes, hundreds of jobs will be gone forever.
It's not going to affect us when that plant is shut down. Just everybody we love around here is going to go, and that's sad.
Ultimately, Congress will determine the budget. Jobs here could also depend on how raw uranium sells on the open market. The project makes some money every year from unenriched uranium sales, and there are thousands of rusty barrels of that just sitting here. In Pike County, Ohio, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
I was stuck on a plane, so I didn't have to choose, but viewers had a television programming dilemma last night. Packers at Detroit on Thursday Night Football, and oh man, what a finish. Or over on NBC, that network's third live musical broadcast, The Wiz. Early numbers are that 11.5 million people tuned in to watch Mary J. Blige, Queen Latifah et al. That's more than double the network's typical audience for Thursday night. And by and large, they weren't hate-watching the way we had with the network's two previous live events, Peter Pan and The Sound of Music. In fact, reviews for The Wiz have been mostly positive. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at why things were different this time. Come on, he's on down
the road. Who doesn't remember at least some of the songs from The Wiz? Love for those songs helped ratings for The Wiz sail past Peter Pan, but it fell short of The Sound of Music. Still, NBC was able to charge premium rates for ads, and according to Nielsen, it got lots of Twitter love. 1.6 million individual tweets were sent out about the broadcast.
These days, a very solid primetime showing.
Jim Nail is an analyst with Forrester Research.
I think what they learned between Sound of Music and Peter Pan is they have to be very careful about the title that they select.
Executive producer Craig Zaden and his partner Neil Marin didn't realize that Peter Pan had sort of worn out its welcome with viewers.
We also made a choice to cast it with great actors, but not with huge stars. And we discovered that that doesn't work.
So for The Wiz, they got big names like Queen Latifah and Mary J. Blige. It also helps that The Wiz has a very loyal audience. Here's Marin.
It was the first time on film, there was a big-budget Hollywood musical that featured an all-African-American cast. It was the first time on Broadway that a black musical won the Tony Award for Best Musical. So it's also significant in terms of the African-American culture.
That may help NBC chase its competitors and their hits. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, the topic of which is, I think, probably a net positive for humanity. Maybe you guys saw this earlier, but I've been traveling, as I said. Turns out, according to CNN, that Toys R Us isn't going to renew the lease on its massive flagship store in Times Square. You know, the one with the Ferris wheel inside and the ridiculous crowds and the giant T-Rex looming over it all? Last day is December 30th, so there is still time if you just have to see all of it. A couple of months ago, the company closed down the FAO Schwartz up on Fifth Avenue, and that, now that, was sad. All right, quitting time. Today, in the face of that jobs report, the Dow up 369 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ up 104 points, 2%. The S&P 500 picked itself up 42 points. That's about 2% there as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around these parts. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. Around these parts. I don't know. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.